Hello everyone, this is Mike Quincy connecting the light. My guest today is Keith Blanchard. He is a full-time musician, singer, spiritual teacher and author, and he has had profound experiences for most of his life, including UFO and alien encounters, angelic apparitions, and also quite an experience when he went to India to seek out a holy man and experience his divinity. Keith tells me that his presentation comes from a place of empowering people so that they can experience and an open heart and a higher plane of consciousness. So that's fine. Welcome to the program, Keith.
Thank you, Michael. How are you today, sir?
Very well, thank you. Yes, feel fine. It's midsummer here over in England, and we've been having a nice little spell, so I think it always makes you feel a bit better. Anyway, Keith, my first question to you is, having had all these different type of experiences, what made you feel that you wanted to put it to use to help other people?
I saw what my experiences did for me, and growing up in a family with someone who was afflicted with a condition, she was my greatest teacher, my sister, and it taught me compassion. Her presence taught me compassion, how to treat people, how not to treat people. And when these experiences started to happen in my life, I just knew I wanted to give the gift of empowerment to those around me so they can begin to live empowered lives, creating the best life for themselves. It just brings me joy to know that people's lives are affected by a touch, a look, a word, a gesture from me. It makes me feel whole. It makes me feel like I'm plugged in and doing my part.
Right, that's very nice. Now, so having been to India, and you can explain in a minute what prompted you to do that, and you speak of a holy man, presumably part of your what you want to hand on to people has a spiritual content. Would that be true?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that experience then. What made you go to India in the first place, and what actually happened?
I was teaching a spiritual class here in Memphis, Tennessee, a place called the Connection Center, and after the service, a friend of mine came up to me, and we started a chat. And I asked about some of these pictures they had on the wall. They had a wall with a lot of pictures. And some of the deities on the wall I knew, and some I didn't. And when I got to this particular person by the name of Sathya Sai Baba, I inquired about it. I didn't know of his presence on the planet at that time. And he proceeded to tell me about Sai Baba and his mission. In fact, he pulled off of the altar this little canister full of ash, telling me that Sai Baba has the ability to manifest this ash. In fact, the ash came from him. And I was immediately intrigued, so I began to buy every book I can possibly get on the life of Sathya Sai Baba. And as I started to submerge myself in this presence of this man's life and his teachings, he started coming to me in dream experiences, and I was as conscious in these experiences as I am talking to you on the phone. And one night in sleep, he came to me and brought me to a state of full-blown consciousness, asking me, telling me, suggesting that I should go to India. And, of course, my human logic kicks in, wondering when I go, how will I get there, how I'm going to put this all together, where's the money going to come from. And he assures me, Keith, put all these ideas aside, that the way will be provided. So I wake up the next morning excited that I'm going to India. And a week later, I get a phone call from someone I've never in my life met. Hi, Keith, my name is Debbie. We have a mutual friend. I heard you want to go to India. Is this true? And I said, yes, ma'am, it is. And she says, well, I'm a flight attendant, and I have some companion passes that are for the year that are about to expire, and I would hate to throw them away knowing that you would want to go to India. And so she gives me a round-trip ticket first class to go to India. And I take off to this wonderful ashram where I got to experience the most towering divinity of this little short-stature man, and experience things that I would hate to try to describe, because words only soil the level of bliss that I was able to see, the level of grace in the form of a human being in front of me.
Yes, you say a small man. It was only recently that I read that he was only 5 foot 2 inches tall. That surprised me. So I jokingly said that that's why when you're in his presence, he makes everybody sit down. Still, what year did you go there, by the way?
I was there in the year 2000, and there was probably 30-plus thousand people there on this particular two-week pilgrimage I went. And the level of energy of 30-plus thousand people waiting to see this incarnation, you can feel that in and of itself. And when he walks through the gate into the temple, the entire consciousness just shoots through the roof. And when he gets nearer to your area in the temple, and the closer, I mean, you can just feel this energy dynamic just being thrown around. It's just amazing. And I think, I honestly think that a week would have been enough for me, because towards the end of these 2 weeks, I was so informationally pregnant. It was getting uncomfortable. It was really getting uncomfortable.
Yeah. So what made you go there in the first place? I mean, was it that you had already been seeking your, as you might call it, your spiritual home, and you hadn't found it up to that point?
Good, very fantastic question. I'm the kind of guy who dives off the highest diving board to forget what I want, and what I want is absolute peace and enlightenment and knowledge and power. And at that point in my life, you know, I was just wanting, a lot of it was to experience the divinity of Satya Sai Baba. That would be half of it. That would be half true for sure. And the other half was for my own development, so I can see how divinity acts and behaves, so I can be in its close proximity, so I can reap whatever benefits that I may by just being in the presence of this holy man.
Right. Was it following those experiences that you wrote your book, The Divine Principle?
I'm sorry, what was that question again, please?
Was it following those experiences with Sai Baba that you wrote your book, The Divine Principle?
It was exactly the halfway point. It was exactly the halfway point. In fact, once when Sai Baba walked into the temple, I waited. I didn't want to get there the first couple of days I was there and make this about me. There was going to be a season for it. And when it felt appropriate, I asked him in my mind, what do you want me to do? If this book is designed for me to finish, I would love to finish it. But if it's the energy is just not going to follow through and my growth lies elsewhere, I'm willing to put this aside. And I asked him to give me a sign that he gave an author by the name of Robert Priddy. I read in his book called The Source of the Dream, which is he would write in the air with his finger, and this was his sign to Robert Priddy. And I asked him, if you want me to continue writing this book, give me the same sign. And he stopped what he's doing, and he starts writing in the air with his finger. And, of course, this took me back. My humanness says, you know, am I believing what I'm seeing? And I asked him to do it again, and he did it again. And then he did it a third time, and he pointed at me. And so I was fortunate enough to see these kinds of omniscient, omnipotent behaviors, which really congealed and integrated in me something I'm still processing.
Right. So you were obviously resonated with the teachings of Sai Baba. Did you already have a feeling that perhaps you were connected with some of these other types of spiritual movements, shall I call them, as opposed, say, to a typical Christian religious movement?
Yes, very much so. All of my life, God was always with me in the form of an idea and a path that I would pursue. As a young boy, I had this fire, this insatiable appetite for information. Even at a very early age, 6, 7 years old, I remember clearly there were a model of questions that I would constantly run through my consciousness, and I wasn't thinking these questions. They just somehow appeared. Where did I come from? Why am I here? Who am I, and where am I going? And little did I realize these four questions became the unfoldment of my life. And throughout my life, I've always pursued God somehow. I was an altar boy. At the age of 15, I decided I was seriously thinking of becoming a Catholic priest. And then my father throws an electric guitar in front of me, and God goes in the closet. And then I lived the whole musician lifestyle. I played with world-class players, people who play in international mainstream bands. And then finally, that caught up with me, the dark stuff, and it humbled me. I was put on my knees, and I found myself crying out to Spirit, saying, I need to hear your voice. And this prayer particularly, I asked for about 3 weeks. But I'm convinced that my passion and sincerity that I had in my first asking to hear God's voice, so to speak, was enough. And one night after playing music, I was awakened out of my sleep by a voice, looking around the house, thinking my wife was waking me up or a friend. No one in the house. I lay back with the intentions of going back to sleep, dismissing this as a dream or a voice I heard coming out of a dream. And the voice spoke again. And I sat up in bed, surprised, but knowing. And I was thrown back on the bed, and my eyes opened. And when I was thrown back on bed, then my eyes closed. And I found myself standing in the presence of, I can only say, what I know to this day as God. It was light. It was pure. When this voice would speak, it was audible, but I could see it. I could smell the voice. I can taste the voice. It was yeah. everywhere. It was everything imaginable. And it was not separate from me. It was me, but a part of me that I had not known until that moment. And the voice begins to instruct me to sit on my sofa and press record on a tape player, go into light meditation, and get out the way. And I said, well, will I speak about it? It says, if you get out the way, the words will come. So right. I did what it instructed, and out came volumes of the most far-out information I've ever heard. And this began to take shape in the form of the book, You Know It's a Divine Principle.
Right. So is that mainly a result of what you were told, or were you able to ask questions? I mean, was it in the form of a conversation?
It's all of them. Actually, it started off, honestly, in the form of conversation. I would hear these ideas in my head, and I would not feel comfortable for the day until I wrote them out. They were just, to use the word, bothersome, only because they just wouldn't leave me alone. But then the voice started telling me, Keith, we don't have to do this so formally. You sit, ask questions, and I answer. Just be aware that of your thoughts, your feelings, and your life experiences. And in that will be the conversations. Let's say, Michael, you and I would be at a restaurant having a bite of food. And 3 weeks ago, I intended this question. I intended a response to this question. And you and I would be having a bite of food on a particular day. And these people behind us are having conversation. And I'm peripherally aware. And someone would say something. And I would know I was given the answer by the way it made me feel inside. And I would go home and write the answer to the question I posed some weeks before. Or I'd wake up in the morning feeling I had this burning, this information. And I would form a question around the information I got that would be very logical to be receiving such an answer. And so my life became this question and answer dialogue with everything around me. And that's what I used to shape the book.
Right. So were your questions more personal rather than general? I mean, the fact you've written a book about it rather suggests that the information you have is suited to some extent for everybody.
The question, there was maybe a handful of questions that were about me, so to speak. I would say 95% of the questions are about everyone, about the global good, about humanity, for the collective. You know, people want to know answers. And I was fortunate enough to say that I was in alignment to receive such information, not only in the form of information, but as this information would come through me, I was in the most incredible spiritual bliss and being elated. And so I was able to receive, you know, energy on multiple levels. But it was always, I'm always about empowering people. It's what brings me joy. I've been a passionate musician all my life. And now the doors are opening for me to live my new passion, which is empowering people.
Right. Now, that was in 1996.
What have you been
doing with that information in the meantime?
Applying it and seeing my life unfold to a place of effortlessness, easiness. You know, for even though when I had this information, it was still new to me. I was not just the author. I was a reader. I was taking all this in and applying it to my life for 8 years because I didn't want to just recite something in the form of words like a parrot. I wanted to live these principles to know that they were effective and that they were a part of truth and that applying them would bring to me the peace, the joy, the things in life that I deserve, which is my best life. And now that I'm absolutely convinced that this information that I love sharing with people works, I do everything I can to make sure that people are not turned down, that they get what they deserve as their best life.
Right. So what have you learned from that in a manner of speaking that enables you to help other people? I mean, it empowered yourself and you believe you can empower others. I wondered how you approached that.
I played music for so many years, networking with people. I have no problem whatsoever to walk off of stage and just come sit at your table, even though I don't know who you are, and just begin a conversation. I'm very comfortable in doing that. And when I meet people, a touch, a look, a word, a gesture, I've seen the impact that it has when I'm able to fall into a place inside of myself of humility. And it's for me, humility is what creates the disposition for the divine to come in. It creates that available space inside. And when I'm humbled and I live in from a humbling space, I allow the divine to come in and I operate from that place. And something as small as just a touch on someone's shoulder, that would be the entire conversation. I've seen the effect it has. I've seen how it changes their body posture. I see how it creates a doorway for an amazing friendship. And that's my approach, is just being humble and making myself available to someone who may need someone to talk to, who may need a few kind words.
Right.
It's humility for me.
You have called yourself a spiritual teacher. What you've been describing at the moment rather suggests you're talking of more of a one-to-one contact. But do you actually use all your knowledge to give talks or hold workshops or that sort of thing?
I do. In fact, I just came to South Louisiana to have a reunion with my family. And I just made a couple of phone calls, see if there would be people interested in listening to a presentation in my dad's home. My dad has a beautiful place out here in South Louisiana, and it was packed. It was a very much success. I do lots of radio interviews. I do TV interviews. And so, yes, I am bringing my message to the masses and being very well received. And so I'm really, really blessed and grateful.
So when you give these talks, how do you approach it in the sense that what is it you really have to offer people who, I would guess, are more interested in knowing what God is?
Well, I'm the guy next door. You know, everybody has their delivery, their way, and my way is just being me. I'm definitely not one of being clinical. I'm definitely not one about doing things the way most people do it, does it, for no other reason except just being me. I just come across as just guy, that is this approachable guy, and I have no agenda. It's effective. It works for me. I don't like playing this intimidating role that there's a spiritual teacher or this guru and I can never aspire to that kind of place because, you know, by God, that's just not me. I like the simplicity of who I am, and people mirror that back to me. And so it's really not one-sided at all that I'm the teacher, believe me. When I'm teaching or speaking in front of these people, I'm very much a student. And that gives me an equally powerful charge as well.
Right. But having said that, if you were, say, talking to me, for example, And I said, I don't really understand what God is or what he or she does, etc. I mean, what would you be likely to tell me in trying to give me an understanding of what God is?
For me, God is the absolute awareness. It is absolute power. It is absolute freedom. It is absolute peace. It's the part of you that is love in its totality. It's afraid of nothing. It's everywhere all the time. It is the highest idea. It is that which we aspire to. It's the most beautiful idea there is. It is unconditional love. It's the refuge that we all seek. So God, for me, is really not this human construct. And even though we as spiritualists, anyone in the spiritual path, understand that, there's still a part of a large amount of us who believes that God has this human form or humanoid form or is the supreme being. But God is not the supreme being. God is supreme being. Mm-hmm. It's a state of awareness that we can all achieve. And if God is unconditional love, when we begin to purge ourselves and remove everything that is not of love and light, again, humility is an excellent way to do this. It makes us available for the essence of who we are to begin to surface and integrate and express itself into your life.
Right. So how do we bring God into our life in the sense that I believe your one of your messages is that God is within? People may find that difficult to understand. How would you suggest they find it within self?
Passion, courage, an intent. It's an intent to want it. You know, people who dabble in spirituality likely will never get there. You have to want it. You have to want it beyond anything, because that intention is the key that unlocks the doors. You just have to want it, and it's a 24/7 job for the rest of your life. And job is just a play on words, but make it fun. Spirituality, your road to God, is your passion, no more, no less. And it's a process of removing the fear. You have to go inside and revisit those places that you've shut off just because they were too tough. You have to be willing to go through hell within yourself to get to heaven within yourself. It's a focus. It's an unbroken focus of truly desiring peace and becoming it.
Right. There would be some people that would hold to the belief that we are made in God's image, and I guess sometimes they perhaps get it the wrong way around, and they think God must be in our image rather than the reverse. But what is it do you think that we are the image of as far as God is concerned?
Growing up Catholic, most people, at least in the church I was in, believed that God created in his image to somewhat look like him. And that may seem funny, but it's true. I mean, people, we have that model in our head, this engram, this groove in our psyche. And when God made us in his image, for me, I believe it's he made us in his image and his likeness. If God is the creator, it's the creative force, it's the creative principle in the universe. As we think, feel, and do, we create. And if we create by default, we might as well become conscious of the fact that every thought we think, every feeling we feel, every action we take molds, shapes, and brings to us in our life. It unfolds life. And so we might as well become conscious so we can create deliberately.
Right. So having, say, entered this path of becoming godlike, where does it lead us to? What is sort of the object?
You know, I guess there's 6 billion plus people on the planet, and everybody has their own vision of heaven. And to me, heaven is your life going right with or without a body, and hell is your life going wrong with or without a body. And so I would think everybody wants the same thing, which is the highest greatest possible life that they envision for themselves, be it in a physical nature or be it in just spiritual bliss. And so for me, the path to God is just, you know, what can I get from this experience? I always look for the deepest meaning in every experience in my life. Even those experiences, I wish that never showed up, believe me.
Yes,
they're not always fun. But there is a diamond in the peanut butter. You know, if the peanut butter is likened to a bad experience, there is a diamond in there. And the fact that it's a diamond doesn't change. And so I'm constantly peeling the layers of the onion, hoping to get to the core of the experience, because for most people, being, you know, human, our nature is we're hard-headed sometimes. And sometimes it takes that experience, which is a treasure in disguise. And, you know, you can either react to the situation or you can become conscious and transform it into something of beauty.
Right. So what do you think happens to us when we die?
That largely depends on the person who's dying, who has died. Being a spiritualist, for many people, our whole lives, we pursue higher consciousness, light, if you will. When I die, what I've been pursuing all my life, not implying that it's not here now, mind you, but when we cross into a spiritual plane, seems a little easier because we don't have the buffer of time and physicality to get in the way, to prolong the experience. But if I was to die, what I've been pursuing all of my life, the light, higher consciousness, I'm going to run to it. Someone who may come from a dogmatic background, who may not believe such ways, who may believe in guilt, punishment, devil. Now, when they die, the last thing they want to do with this belief system is run to a light or a higher consciousness that they believe is going to put them in a fiery pit. In so doing, they can create a self-induced hell by their own guilt, and they can stay in that spiritual fetal position until they choose to release themselves of the self-inflicted guilt. And that in and of itself could be the hell for them, which might be they may find themselves in the lower astral plane. What's there, you can bet, be sure to get the punishment that they may feel is due. So they're not being judged. It's just guilt. And when you're on the other side, thoughts can manifest immediately. There is not the buffer of time. But I think largely, even those people who may believe such ways and go to a place of bliss, it's definitely a higher level of reality than they may feel here. So I think everybody is assured some relief.
Right. Have you ever had an out-of-the-body experience and sort of entered the astral realms or areas that might be considered to be the like of heaven?
I did, and I have them often, and then they usually come through sleep. And again, for the listening audience, it's not that I'm sleeping and I'm having these far-out dreams. I'm just as conscious as I am now. But sleep seems to be when I am most ready to launch, to use a word. I've had experiences with angelic beings imparting information to me for the divine principle. I was fortunate many times to hang out, to use a word, with Sathya Sai Baba, watching Tibetan masters being initiated and other levels of reality. I've had experiences with a human being who was not a human being. His name was, let's just call him Chuck, an alien individual, who's done in the waking world some pretty phenomenal things in front of my face. One of those things was asking me to lay down in the bed, and he's been promising me a journey. And one day he says, "Keith, do you want to take that journey today?" And of course my answer is, "You can bet." And so he says, "Lay down in the bed, and Keith, all I want you to do is relax. Don't do anything, just relax." And so as I'm laying down in the bed, he grabs hold of my hand, and slowly but surely begins to pull on my arm, just tugging on me, slowly but surely stretching my arm out. And as this person, being, entity, is pulling on my arm, everything I know as me begins to leave my body through my arm. And after he got me out about 5-6 feet, he lets go and he says, "What's the matter, Keith?" I said, "I'm trying to figure out what and what not to do to make this happen." He goes, "That's your problem right there." Keith, just let go. And he begins to pull again. And I got a little better at the process because I got out about 15 or so feet. Mm-hmm. And he lets go. And he says, Keith, we're going to stop. I said, why? What's the matter? He goes, I cannot violate your free will. And some part of you is still holding on. And so we're going to stop here. He goes, but describe to me what you've seen. And I saw his ship. I saw where in the galaxy it's located. I saw the technology that ran the ship. When I walked into, keep in mind, his second tug was only 8 seconds maybe. But in this 8 seconds, I was able to experience a graduation loss of time. The fact that time was not the same there, I was able to walk into the ship. My first thought when I walked into this craft was, where are all the chairs? The chairs appeared out of the wall. When I was done with the thought, the chairs go back into the wall. Mm. I saw a bio on this individual. He is part of a board of 12, 27,000 light years away from here. He's actually a galactic police officer. He roams around the galaxy policing it. And so I was able to experience this person for quite a few years, for about 4 or 5 years. We befriended each other, and I've seen the most phenomenal things that, one, people would not understand, two, they would not believe.
Right. Now, immediately some people's eyebrows are going to lift up hearing you say that his galaxy was 27,000 light years away. Yeah. And they're going to say, how can he get here?
He works through the body of a woman. It's a male. When I first met this person, a friend of mine says, Keith, do you want to meet an alien? And she's a very witty girl. And that day she was being equally as funny. But there was something serious in her eyes and in her voice. She says, follow me. And I didn't know what to expect. I honestly did not know that after I taught this class, I was going to, you know, see a little green man hop out from behind the corner and say boo. I didn't know what to expect when she walks me up to this 5'1" woman. And when I walked up to this person, I really didn't know what to say. How do you greet an alien? Nanu, nanu? I honestly didn't know. And the first thing that comes out of his mouth is, what do you want from me? And it was a male's voice, and there was such power and presence and awareness. It took me back. I lost my balance, so to speak, because, one, I was not expecting a male's voice when this person honestly does not even speak like this. The intellect, to use a word, was alien. And the first thing it asked is, what do you want from me? And with that question, I didn't know how to respond. And it said, let me help you with that. What you want is data. It didn't say information. It didn't say enlightenment. It didn't say be friends. It said data, which is an alien word, the way it was being used. And he was actually playing with me, trying to open me up and lighten the situation because he knew I was uncomfortable because I knew this was actually transpiring. And so we befriended each other. And we just became the best of friends. And he works through this woman. I mean, I don't know the exact way that he gets his consciousness here. It could be just a simple act of will. I know that he has awareness on 6 dimensions simultaneously. I know that for sure. And so, again, time and space is probably very, very different from where he's at. And just a simple act of will can probably tune in light frequencies here and there. As easy as we would dial in a radio station, I'm sure.
Mm. I think it would would be a bit pointless in asking you if he told you the name of his galaxy, because presumably we wouldn't have any idea of it, as it's that far away anyway. But was he humanoid? What did he look like? Or she, I should say.
She was a Caucasian woman, 5'1". Spoke with this really squeaky, without insulting, just the description, mousy kind of voice. And when this presence was in the body, it was just, gosh, it was just so robust. You can feel, you can feel how tall this entity was. 6'11", 7 foot, milky white skin, the almond-shaped dark eyes, hair, 6 digits on each hand, each foot. It was half gray, half Egyptian. His mother, his father was an Egyptian king. His mother was an alien gray, and so he was a hybrid. And in the time that he and I hung around, he was 4,720-some-odd years old. Now, their technology is such that he being 4,700-plus years old, let's say for whatever reasons other than the fact that you would be decapitated, if you died of what they would consider a natural cause, they have the technology, they could rejuvenate your body to live half of what you just lived. And if you die again of natural causes, they can rejuvenate you to live half of that time. But when you die the fourth time, you're spent, you're gone. You'd go to another level entirely. But he also would tell me about these beings that they call mothers. And now keep in mind, he's a male. I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but he's male. And the fact that he's a hybrid, he was almost seven foot tall. But they have these entities in their race, these beings in their race. They call them mothers, and they're a little shorter in stature. But these beings are so enlightened by a look, by an intention, they can literally grab you and pull you into themselves so that you can experience other galaxies and another universe entirely. This is their level of consciousness. Hmm. I didn't have that fortunate opportunity to experience that. But, you know, being around this person for 4 or 5 years, I've seen some really, really phenomenal things that this person does by mere intention.
Quite incredible. Yeah. If you haven't already done it, is it your intention to write a book about those particular experiences?
No, I do have a book out now, two more, which are companions to the Divine Principle, called Divine Daily Supplements, which is a thought for the day book, and also one called the Self-Reflection Workbook, which is people for those who want to get intensive and extensive with their growth. Basically, why do I believe what I do? Where did I learn this belief? It's basically a clearing process. But in fact, next week I have a children's book series coming out called Eden Sky Wonders Why. It's modeled after my son, Eden Sky. It's about children who ask those big questions that parents don't always find comfortable to answer.
Right, yes.
Like, where do little children come from? Why do little children get sick and die? So that'll be out shortly, and I have a movie coming out in about 2 months, documentary, a company in New York called Blue Cast Productions read my book before it went bestseller, and they said, we're looking to do a documentary movie about someone who lives their passion. And obviously, you're the guy. So they came to Memphis. We filmed for 2 weeks. The movie is called Do What You Love, A Path to Passionate Living. I go around Memphis finding who is living their passion. And those who are not, I give them power tools so they can begin to put that into practice and see their best life come into fruition.
Mm, you're certainly a busy man.
Yes.
Just one more question relating to your ET experience. When you mentioned the craft, could you describe it at all? I mean, I'm a UFO fan, and I'd be very interested to know what it looked like.
The craft itself, you know, I honestly don't recall the outside shape. I can say that it felt like the craft that you would see one person driving, kind of like a sports car kind of model. It was souped up. It was sleek. It wasn't a lot to it. It was small, but it was very, very powerful. It had speed. You know, if he's a galactic cop, I guess that would apply as above, so below. You know, he needs a very fast machine, something very sleek, something that can maneuver. I'm serious. And that's the way I can describe the outside. But I've had experiences with this being in sleep states of consciousness. He called me, Michael, one day, and we used to have a meditation group between 7 or 8 of us. And he was the, quote, leader. He was a little more enlightened than us on different levels. But we all had an equal voice. But he called me one day and said, Keith, everyone in our group has an implant but you. Do you want? I have one left, and I make them myself, and they're smaller than you can see. Do you want the last one? I said, okay, convince me. Here's your moment. Convince me that I want this. He says, well, if you are sick and you need medicine, we can administer medicine through it. If you are lost, quote, lost, for whatever reasons, we can find you. If you're in trouble, we can help you. And he named a few other perks. And I said, okay, lay it on me. What are the drawbacks? He says, there's only one. Your life is no longer private. And he says, but I can tell you, being number 8 on a board of 12, no one, and being head of security on my planetary station, no one has access to your file but me. And I would only look and peruse through that file knowing that you would want me to because you needed help. I said, deal. He says, okay, the next time you and I speak, be it over the phone or face-to-face, this will be implanted. I said, okay. So that night, I go play music. I play at a casino. I play 7 sets, which is lots of work. I come home tired, and I'm awakened, come to a state of consciousness about 6:30 in the morning because I'm in excruciating pain, and the pain is coming from my kidney region, my right kidney region. And even though I'm in sleep, I'm looking over my right shoulder to find out, why is this happening? Where is this pain coming from? And only to find what I would call the equivalent of a 70-year-old human woman sticking this thing into my kidney. And she's laughing at me like, you silly boy, kind of thing. And I'm asking telepathically, why are you laughing? She goes, Keith, you're the one that went into this with the idea that this is going to be painful. And so I become so nauseous in the experience, I begin to vomit. And she carries me to where he's sitting in the planetary station. And it's as if he's sitting in what we would call a lawn chair. And I go into this another bout of vomiting, and I vomited all over his feet. And as this is happening, Michael, my phone rings in my physical bedroom and wakes me up and pulls me out of this experience. And, of course, I wake up with this groggy voice, hello, and it's him, and he's laughing. Hey, Keith, good morning. This is Nucleus. I said, well, what are you doing, dude? I just had a dream about you. He says, no, you didn't. And I'm like, man, don't tell me. I'm telling you, I just had a dream about you. He goes, no, Keith, you were not dreaming. You were conscious. I said, you sure about that? He says, you were actually here. And I said, you sure about that? He says, the vomit all over my feet tells me you were.
Oh, dear.
And when you have these kinds of experiences, you know, the listening audience may say, well, this guy's kind of far out there. Trust me, they will change you, you know, bones to bones, inside and out. They wake you up. They validate those things that you've always wanted to believe in. And even as a spiritualist now, would love to believe is true. It is. It's all real.
Having come this far with your experiences, I have to think that you believe a soul experiences many lives. And I'm wondering whether the fact that you seem to have taken so easily to this ET experience, whether you feel you too might have come perhaps from one of these other perhaps constellations or whatever. You must have thought about that, I suppose.
Yeah, I have some recollections of doing some things. And as far as giving a message, if you've read The Divine Principle, there is a chapter in the end called The Return of the Christ. And Christ is plural, but it also talks about the return of the one we know as Yeshua, Jesus. And, yeah, you know, I've fought this idea for many, many years. And this idea of Yeshua's return would not leave me alone. And I did a lot of prayer, a lot of meditation surrounding this particular subject. In fact, I was really resistant in putting it in The Divine Principle. And I had to find a space of humility to feel okay with it, because there was a large part of my ego that did not want to be wrong, responsibly so. But I had an apparition one night with two angelic beings, and they spoke to me in each ear, and they were one voice, and they said, Keith, we've asked you to log this information, and so I did. So my point of setting it the answer up this way is because in writing that chapter, I would have glimpses of what it was like to be the one to announce the arrival of a Christed being, John the Baptist energy, so to speak. I'm not in no way implying that I was this being. But the energy the task was the same, announcing the arrival of a holy man. And so I was able to dabble, literally project my consciousness to such an experience. But all of my life, I call myself in my bio that you may have read, an extraterrestrial target. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. They come to me and they yank me out of my body, and I find myself on a craft. And so I see that these experiences that I've had in shifts of awareness are not only are there experiences I'm having in this life, but these experiences I'm having are actually reflections and remembrances of other lives. That me going to that place in an out-of-body experience is very likely me living in that experience then, and I'm just remembering it. I'm making the bridge, the connection. Mm-hmm.
So do you actually believe then that very soon there will be the return of the Christ or the Christ consciousness?
Well, the Christ consciousness is returning now, and it's happening through everyone. But as far as the man that we know as Yeshua ben Joseph, you know, from the writings of the Divine Principle, it's happening. When I was in India, Michael, I'm sitting here, and I'm in the ashram, and I'm in the temple, and I buy this, and it's a very long story, but I'm going to keep it very short. I buy this japa mala from outside the ashram. Sai Baba comes in. I ask him to bless it. He skips right over me and blesses everybody else. And I'm going like, you know, what the heck? You know, you just skipped me? And so the whole time I'm in India, I never took a nap. And that day I get very sleepy. Something is inducing sleep. It's not like I'm getting sleepy because I want to go rest. Something is inducing sleep. So I go lay down. Satya Sai Baba comes to me and tells me, Keith, I'm going to tell you something you've been hearing since you was a child. The return of the one that you know as Jesus Christ is coming. And he showed me this treasure chest, and it had all these gold inscriptions and these carvings and these sacred geometry. And there was a group of us, and we all lift up the lid, and there's a gold figurine, which was a crib, and there's a gold figurine of two goats, and there's a gold figurine of a throne. And he says, Keith, the one that you know as Jesus Christ will sit in his throne. He's going to be born through a family of goat herders, and this is going to happen in 5 months, he told me. 5 months to the day, I wake up into a dreaming experience. I'm knocking on a golden door, an open door, and there's Satya Sai Baba standing there pointing at this child. And so, as far as, and in fact, a friend of mine who was not a Satya Sai Baba follower, he was a Catholic, started following Satya Sai Baba's path, happened to go see Sai Baba on Christmas Day, and had no idea of my book and this information about the birth of Christ, Christmas Day, birth of Christ. And he's in Whitefield at Sai Baba's other ashram, and Sai Baba walks out of his room holding a sign in the air that says, Jesus walks among us. And so I really don't know. But for me, it's not about being right, that is the truth, that he's actually here. For me, it's about a vision. It's about, you know, to me, the imagination of it is enough. It serves its purpose to expand people out of the boxes. You know, Christ is probably one of the most famous teachers. And if the consciousness of that religion and that particular teacher's followers alone would shift, it would have an amazing impact on the world.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Now, do I understand what you said correctly here, that Christ has rebirthed on the earth, and he's the child of some goat herders, and that is not very long ago. So would this Christ being still be a young person?
Yes, he would be 11 years old. And the purpose of him coming, and he supposedly lives in the Yucatan Peninsula. Now, I don't know this through hearsay. I know this from my experiences with divinity, being my higher self, or being my higher self through Satya Sai Baba. I've had validation of this. I'm comfortable enough to even air this to the public. Now, as far as me being right, doesn't bother me whatsoever. But the purpose of him coming in at such an early age is to show the disposition of being childlike to enter. His purpose is to break down the collective adult ego. And
right
now, probably starting to surface in some of the remote areas and the villages around where he's at. And believe it or not, he's actually come to me quite a few times in experiences saying, Keith, like it or not, I am here. and I will be ringing your phone, so to speak, very soon. So I've learned to live with this idea, be it that I was right or be it that I was wrong. I'm okay either way. It doesn't change my love and my want to empower people. You know, I've explored the idea. You know, people may come at me with, how dare you talk about my Lord and Savior this way attitude. I've come to peace with that.
That's very interesting. So there is, at this time, and I'm sure you're aware of this, a lot of people talking about the end of the year 2012, which they see as the end of this cycle and the beginning of a new one, but accompanied by an ascension process. Now, is that part of your beliefs?
I think the ascension process is now. I don't doubt that the energy is going to align in such a way. You know, if the Mayans saw it, they actually documented it. If you believe that there's a collective consciousness that has this most amazing power, and you have all these people believing in this idea, it doesn't matter whether one's right and the other's wrong. I mean, we have this amazing power that is building, and it's reaching a state of climax. And so I do believe that they're all purposeful, and they're all creating this alignment. The planetary bodies are falling into alignment. The moon has an amazing effect on the tides on the Earth, and we're made of water. So imagine this amazing gravitational force pulling. And I believe it's all true, but I personally think the ascension process is now. It's every day. It's, you know, and I always said this, for those who are listening and you have any issues in your life, it's very, 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 very important that you become clear with your issues. Because if you don't, as this divine energy moves and wins its way through everyone on the planet, it's going to exponentiate. And there can come a time in your life when your troubles can manifest so big and so large and so out of balance that you will not be able to play with this energy, to manipulate it, to correct it, so you can have balance and peace in your life. And in such an experience, you will likely somehow take yourself off of this planet.
Yes, indeed. Well, I believe in this process myself, and I think your feelings about it are quite correct. People can't take it for granted, in other words, that they will automatically go through with this change. You've got to be prepared for it.
And absolutely, and you know, I think if we become the change, those events, those earth changes, anything that creates disaster, doesn't matter what it is, will be for naught, because the goal, God, if there is such a thing, God's goal is unity. Let me restate that. It's not God's goal is unity. God is unity, and I believe God is becoming, it's expressing itself in the physical way. If God is likened to a light bulb inside of a movie projector, and the light bulb inside that projector is white, it's pure, it has no agenda except to express itself and shine.
Right.
And if we are, what you know as you is the canister in the film. As that light projects itself through what you know as you, whatever is in the way, your filter, your emotions, your thoughts, your feelings, that light will project itself to the 3D screen of reality. If you do not like the movie you are watching, you have to change the film. Like it or not, that is a law, and there's nothing you can do about it. So you might as well become conscious.
I'm going to have to stop you there, because as nice as it is to speak with you, and I'd love to continue, we've unfortunately come to the end of our time. So just very quickly, would you like to give our listeners your website address?
Well, thank you. You can reach me at thedivineprinciple.com. There's an opt-in box there. Fill it out. I'm all about sending you free stuff. There is no agenda. Free stuff. You can reach me at info@thedivineprinciple.com for email. So please stay in contact with me. I'm all about people, and I love a good friendship.
It's wonderful. It's been very interesting to talk to you, and I think the sincerity of what you're doing comes through very clearly and loudly in the stories you've got to tell. So thank you very much for coming on to the program.
Thank you for a wonderful program. Thank you again, sir.
You've been very welcome. Right, friends, next week, my guest is Paul Reinig. I'll be brief about it. He wants to put over the idea that we are not separate from God and that we should not feel unworthy in the core of our essence. And he wants to talk about the consequences of our ability to love unconditionally, that being, of course, a very desirable thing. So thank you for being with me today. I do hope you can make it next week. So God bless you all. Thank you.